Oh, shivers.
Somebody on a dialysis machine in a cave didn't have NORAD stand down, didn't do war games of flying planes in the buildings that morning, didn't do CIA insider trading, didn't call Mayor Willie Brown and tell him not to fly and Ashcroft and everybody else.
Yo. What really happened on September 11th when 3,000 citizens were sent into heaven? Why the era fake Bin Laden video confession? Why's the fairy tale version got so many questions? Were radical hijackers that were only using box cutters, sliced up pilots like a knife cutting hot butter? They had us frantic like a NASDAQ stock runner. They flew in planes like a Tom Cruise top gunner. But the story's bogus, I noticed. Dick Cheney ran 9/11 drinking Diet Sprite sodas. You only gotta look at how the buildings collapsed. Bombs popping off, listen, cause I'm building effects. A controlled demolition had a molten pool of steel up at ground zero. That's the temperature to drown heroes. Fires in the buildings that were oxygen starved. People waving from the windows where the bombing had started. So let me get this straight. These fires couldn't melt people of glass, but they could melt 47 steel frames. World Trade 7 wasn't hit by a plane, and 5 p.m. collapsed, and they couldn't explain. Now for the third time in history, a steel building melted in a neat little pile. Had it happened, such a mystery. The owners said pull it and admitted they knew. That's Larry Silverstein, the partner with the Blackstone.
9/11 was an inside job by Roy Shivers or Roy Shivers, I'm not sure which. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and the illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org, click on the Listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourself. Your support keeps us on the air. You can reach me at unspun@kkrn.org. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Last week, we started an in-depth discussion about the truths of the events of 9/11. Today, we're going to continue that discussion with Christopher Bolin. Chris is a 9/11 truth activist, and he has been challenging the official story of the events of 9/11 for a dozen years. He's an American journalist from Schaumburg Township, Illinois, who has investigated the events of 9/11 since 2001. In 2005 and 2006, he helped Professor Stephen E. Jones, who found evidence of an explosive form of super thermite in the dust of the demolished Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. Dr. Jones and a team of scientists later published a peer-reviewed paper on that crucial discovery that disproves the government version of what caused the towers to fall. In August of 2006, Chris Bolin was attacked at his home in Hoffman Estates, Illinois, by a heavily armed three-man squad of undercover police, which he had seen prowling around his house for several days and called 911 to report. The results of the police assault was Bolin was falsely charged with assault and resisting arrest, both misdemeanor charges. After failing to get a fair trial in Cook County Court, and rather than allow the repression of his work, Bolin made the decision to move his family to Europe in June of 2007. There he began working on two books on 9/11. They are Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. He and his family are currently living in Scandinavia. You will find most of his work and other interviews and other links at his website at www.bolin.com home. Chris, welcome back to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Good morning, Doug. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you back. We had interesting comments and some responses from our last discussion last Saturday, and so I want to kind of pick up from sort of, or maybe we should just recap first. I know you wanted to say something right off the bat, so I'm going to let you make your statement, and then I'll take it back, and we'll do a little recap of last week.
Okay. Well, I don't know, your audience, your listening audience, what they know about 9/11. But currently, more than half the American population does not believe the official version of what happened in 9/11. And that's really a huge number. It varies between 50% to as much as 80, 85% of the population does not believe what the government has told us about 9/11. I mean, 9/11 is the seminal event which brought us to where we are today, which has given us these two wars of aggression in Afghanistan and Iraq, which have, you know, more than doubled the defense spending per year, so that, you know, we've reached a huge debt crisis where the government has shut down. We have a, you know, Obama administration in there that still maintains the cover-up of what really happened in 9/11, while it furthers and maintains the war agenda. So my point is that we, 9/11 skeptics, we who are asking for a proper investigation of what really happened on 9/11, we are not the radical. We are not the unreasonable one. We're the voice of common sense. We want 9/11 to be thoroughly investigated and prosecuted for the crime that it was. The radicals are the ones who are using, exploiting the events of 9/11 to wage illegal wars of aggression and to defraud the nation. So I just want to make that statement to, you know, your audience that you know, if we're the ones who are questioning what happened on 9/11, we're not the madmen here. We're not the radicals.
Yes, and I want another point, and kind of a along that same line, a lot of people, when they hear any criticism of Israel, start screaming anti-Semitic. And me personally, you know, I was engaged to a Jewish girl while I was in college, and I grew up in a neighborhood that was 60% Jewish, so I have no anti-Semitic feelings at all. So, and I can't speak for you, but I'm pretty sure you come from a pretty objective place. That's not, you know, prejudice is not dictating your findings.
No, not at all. Not at all. I actually, the fact that I started traveling after high school, and I went to the Middle East when I was just 18 years old, and I wandered around in Iran and Syria, and I wound up in Israel, and I wound up living on a kibbutz. One of the most Zionist establishments that exist on the face of this planet. I mean, and so that experience that I had in Israel, I went back several times, it really informed my understanding of what the state of Israel is all about.
And, you know, we can do a whole show on that one day. But I want to go back and recap kind of what we talked about last week, because I don't want to go over information. I'd like to kind of build on where we were. And for the people that weren't listening last week, you can go to KKRN's website and look under shows. And or maybe, I think it's on the front page still, the home page. You'll see a link there to last week's interview with Chris Bolin. And you may want to listen to that. Not now, though, but you want to go back and inform yourself that way. Last week, we covered some of the most damning evidence that disproves the official story and the findings of the 9/11 Commission. We touched on the failure of NORAD to intercept the hijacked planes, the failure of the Bush administration to heed numerous warnings before the attacks or to investigate the attacks at all. And then we talked about the fact that no steel skyscrapers had ever collapsed from a fire in history. And we discussed the presence of nanothermite residue and tiny iron spheres being present in the dust from the collapsed World Trade Centers, and the fact that both of these facts support the theory that the towers were brought down by controlled demolition explosives. I had a friend ask last week about another building that collapsed at the World Trade Center complex on that same day. And so I'm going to ask you that question, and his question is, what can you tell us about Building 7, and why is this important in trying to understand what happened on 9/11?
Oh, Building 7 is the key question. It's the unexplained 47-story skyscraper that fell at 5:25 in the afternoon. So that's hours after the events of 9/11 in the morning. The dust had settled. And suddenly at 5:25, this 47-story building, which is about 350 feet away from the North Tower, it had been damaged a little bit by, you know, debris, because debris had been ejected from the North Tower at great velocity, and some debris had hit the front of that building and broken windows. There were some sporadic fires in the building, but, you know, then again, this is a modern building built in 1986, steel frame building. And at 5:25, it just fell straight down, directly into its footprint. and it fell, like the other buildings, at free fall acceleration. And so it was falling at the speed of a falling object, which indicates that there was no resistance below, which like in the both in a tower, in the case of all the towers, indicates that the steel structure below it was being destroyed as fast as the top was falling, or faster. And this building had the Office of Emergency Management on floor 22 or 23, which was Giuliani's emergency hardened bunker. And, you know, there's speculation, there were people in the building before, during 9/11, that maybe this was part of the control area for the demolitions of the towers 1 and 2. But in any case, this building was owned by Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder of buildings 1 and 2. So Larry Silverstein actually lost three buildings on 9/11, towers 1, 2, and 7. And, you know, he was reimbursed early on for the collapse of that building, something $450 million right away. I called up the insurance company and asked them, how could they reimburse for the loss of a building when they didn't even know what had caused the building to collapse? I mean, this is how ridiculous the whole thing is, that these insurance companies have reimbursed Larry Silverstein without even understanding, you know, what caused the collapse of these buildings. So this 9/11 was, of course, a classic insurance fraud, among other things.
And what was the insurance company's answer? Did they have an answer, or did they just declined to answer?
Yeah, they didn't answer the question in a meaningful way. I mean, that was an early on call. I made that in like 2002, 2003. I remember it was the insurance company I had something with teachers, and if I remember correctly, it was in Kansas City or someplace out there in that part of the country. But I called them up because they were one of the insurance companies. But this insurance and reinsurance business, and actually who wound up, you know, where the buck ended and who wound up actually coughing up the money, that's even not clear, whether these insurance companies were reimbursed by the federal government or, you know, what have you. But in any case, Larry Silverstein wound up getting reimbursed for the loss of all three buildings. And, you know, in the case of Towers 1 and 2, he was double indemnified for the tune of, you know, billions and billions of dollars. He profited a great deal from that. The money, the whole money story about who financed his acquisition of the towers, and, you know, that was GMAC, the company that then went bankrupt, the General Motors financial arm. They financed Larry Silverstein's acquisition of the first two towers. And you know they went. They're the ones who went bankrupt in 2008.
And were bailed out.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So they were part of the bailout. Yeah, people don't understand that.
Yeah.
People don't understand that part of the bailout. The reason that GM had to be bailed out was that their financial arm, which was usually invested in illegal mortgage backed securities, went under, and that's why they had to be bailed out.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that the first airplane went directly into the both airplanes struck the computer rooms of Towers 1 and 2. The first one went into the computer room of Marsh & McLennan, which is a company that's owned by Maurice Greenberg. And Maurice Greenberg, if you remember from the bailout, was the man who built and owned AIG, the insurance company that was the primary recipient of the bailout money early on, of a tune of like $180 billion, because AIG as an insurance company had insured the investments of companies like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America. So when this $180 billion was given to Maurice Greenberg, he then turned that money directly over to Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and the other companies that AIG had insured. But this coincidence that the airplanes flew into his computer room in the North Tower, and that he's, you know, this key player in this whole financial fraud of the bailout. As, you know, I wrote extensively about that, those connections, on my previous website, Bolin.info, which was actually taken down shortly after the election.
Yeah, there's a lot of the bailout, of course, is a whole other fraud. And the fraud behind the fraud, and as you say, people like Goldman Sachs wouldn't have survived the fraud without insuring themselves against the failure of their own products.
Right.
And if the bail, and that's why AIG went down, is because they were issuing credit default swaps and other insurance against the products that they knew that was going to fall. But I don't want to get distracted. I want to get back to 9/11.
Right.
I had a let me talk about the other things that we kind of figured out last week. I'll kind of condense this down. But we did establish the use of terrorism and false flag attacks as an integral part of not only Israeli policies since before the creation, but other countries as well, including the United States. And but the Israeli history shows that their government has little respect for life or other countries' sovereignty, whether they're allies or enemies. It doesn't seem to have mattered in their history. And we talked about a couple of things, the attack on the USS Liberty, and the one of the things we didn't discuss is the Gaza blockade, but we did, what happened recently, that the Israelis actually killed a Turkish citizen and an American citizen on ships that were simply trying to get to Gaza. And I don't have all the facts on that, but just, and maybe you do, but if you know something about that, I think, because it shows that even today, Israel is willing to work outside the bounds of international law. The ships were in international waters, I believe. Do you know anything about those attacks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was clearly a planned brutal attack in which, as you said, they killed, I think, nine people. One of them was a young American Turkish boy, and he was shot at point blank range in the head several times. These people were massacred. They were exterminated. You know what do you call it?
Executed.
Executed. Yeah, executed. Yeah. And this was in their attempt to reach Gaza to bring humanitarian aid and. It's an atrocity, but the bigger atrocity is what Israel has been doing to Gaza for a long time. And in 2006, I think it was, when they had their last massacre there in Gaza. Now that was the Lebanon. 2008, I guess it was, just before the election of Obama, when Obama was just being elected, Israel again created a terrible aggression against Gaza, and they used white phosphorus bombs. Everybody could see this; they were dropping white phosphorus bombs on the people of Gaza, who are basically a defenseless civilian population, you know, the most densely populated part of the area, perhaps of the earth, and these people have nothing to defend themselves with at all. And here, these Israelis are dropping white phosphorus on these civilians. And you know, when the Goldstein report came out, Judge Goldstein, South African Jewish fellow, came out with this report and identify that Israel committed war crimes, you know, the organized Jewish community attacked him and actually got him after a period of time to, you know, recant. But the findings were the findings. And you know, you ask yourself, when people don't understand the cruelty of Israel or the inhumanity of Israeli policies, just look at what they did to Gaza in 2008 when they dropped white phosphorus on the people there. When white phosphorus hits a person's body, it just burns. It won't stop burning. It will burn through to the bone, and you can't. Water won't extinguish it. Nothing will extinguish it because it's a chemical reaction. So the phosphorus will just burn its way all the way through to the person's bone. I mean, this is a hideous, hideous, obscene weapon, and it's not supposed to be used, of course, at all. It's a banned weapon, but the Israelis used it. And you know, again, they got away with it. Obama said he would have plenty to say about this when he got inaugurated, because this was the limbo period. You know, he was a president-elect at that point. But when he became president, he said nothing. He said nothing.
Yeah, and then we, of course, the things going on in Gaza now have extended over into Egypt, and I don't want to get into all of that right now. But the point of my question was to show that this is not policy that they've abandoned, this kind of terrorist, criminal behavior on international waters, boarding a ship and killing people on a ship that's unarmed. This is not new behavior for them, and they haven't abandoned this kind of behavior at all. It's been part of their makeup since before their inception. So the other thing that we talked about was that there were a number of neoconservatives and people that had been calling for a new Pearl Harbor, and we had talked about who those people were, and they were in the Bush administration at very high levels, and that there were other Zionists in the Bush administration that were also connected to Israel and 9/11. And one of the people that you mentioned was Michael Chertoff, and maybe we can go over that again real quickly. Who is Michael Chertoff, and how was he able to kind of affect the whole perception of 9/11 and the war on terror?
Very good question. Michael Chertoff is the key person in what I call the cover-up of 9/11 because and the non-investigation. Michael Chertoff became the second Homeland Security czar, secretary, they would say. But prior to that, he was the assistant attorney general under John Ashcroft at the Department of Justice. And his department was the Department of Criminal Affairs, which meant that he was the prosecutor. He was the person who would prosecute the crimes of 9/11 because crimes of terrorism fall under the Department of Justice automatically. His investigative arm is the FBI. The FBI works for him. And in the case of 9/11, the FBI's duty, obligation, was to gather the evidence, analyze the evidence, and provide the evidence that he needs for the prosecution. Well, as we all know, there's been no prosecution of the 9/11 crimes. But further than that, there was no investigation. The FBI, which is really fallen from whatever high position it had back in the 40s and 50s, it's now really nothing but a political criminal arm of the government, which you know spends more time setting up crimes than it does solving crimes. But in the case of 9/11, what happened? Michael Chertoff allowed the steel evidence from the World Trade Center, which was all that was remaining, basically, was dust and steel. He basically turned that steel rubble over to the city of New York, and Mayor Giuliani had an office where they simply took the steel and shipped it to a couple junkyards in New Jersey, where the steel 24/7, round the clock, was being cut up into small pieces, mixed with other steel, put into barges, and shipped to China. And just prior to 9/11, they had deepened the channel, the Claremont Channel, that goes from Jersey City, where one of these yards was, and it deepened the channel for ocean-going vessels. And the yard had paid like $30 million to have this, you know, a public-private venture. They had paid to have this channel prepared. So there was a lot of preparation that had been done. And really, an important thing about this, the steel, instead of being sold to plants in Indiana, Pennsylvania, Ohio, what have you, New Jersey, the steel was sent halfway around the world at a time when the price of scrap steel was the lowest it had been in 50 years. Now, that makes no sense, because when you're paying $25 a ton to ship the steel to China, you're losing all your profit. So, you see, what we saw with the steel from 9/11 was the destruction of evidence, and that was done under the authority of Michael Chertoff. I asked him directly. I said, you know, did you authorize this? And he said, no, he didn't. And I said, you know who did? He said, no idea. That's as much as he answered me. But yeah. clearly, the buck ends with him. You don't have to, you know, there's nobody has to prove anything. He was the highest person in power. He's the person whose responsibility was to prosecute the crimes. And he was the person who oversaw the investigation of the FBI, which turned out to be a non-investigation. Because when you destroy the evidence rather than examine the evidence, then you're facilitating a cover-up. Yeah, and that's what he did.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Returning with us today is Christopher Boleyn, journalist, researcher, and 9/11 truth advocate. We're discussing the events of 9/11 and the truths as best we can ascertain them. And if you'd like to join this discussion, you can call in. Our number here is 530-337-1885. 530-337-1885. We invite your calls and your comments. We are, we were just rehashing last week's show, and part of that was Michael Chertoff destroying evidence. You had last week, and I want to quote you on this one, you said, quote, "At every critical point of the 9/11 saga, you have an Israeli Zionist or an Israeli agent or an American Zionist working for the State of Israel. They are not just working for the State of Israel. They are working for the Likud party, which is basically a party of terrorists." And I thought this would be an opportunity for you to maybe line out what some of those critical points were. And who were the Zionists or the agents involved in those critical points?
Sure. Well, there, you know, when you look at the 9/11 saga, you look at the preparation before, the crime itself, and then the investigation and litigation that followed. And in all those areas, you find at every point, you find an Israeli agent or a Zionist making the key decisions that affect the turnout of those events. I mean, prior to 9/11, back in 1987, I think it was, one of the biggest, most famous Zionist Mossad agents, his name is Shaul Eisenberg. He's like called Mr. China or something like that, because he was living basically in China and Japan during World War II, and training these Israeli troops that then went to Palestine and did ethnic cleansing under the name of Beitar or Irgun. Shaul Eisenberg owned a company called Atwell Security, created a company called Atwell Security of Tel Aviv, and this company tried to get the contract, the security contract for the World Trade Center in 1987 under the couple of Mossad agents, Tzvi Malkin and Shalom Ben-Dor. These two men happened to have been involved in the nuclear smuggling of plutonium from Pennsylvania in the 80s. They were involved in the working with Rafi Eitan. They were working with that plutonium smuggling. They were working with the Pollard affair, the spy affair. They were working with the kidnapping of Eichmann from Argentina. You know, all of these. It's a small group of people, you know, Mossad at the top in the 50s and 60s. Well, these characters tried to get the security contract for the World Trade Center in 1987. And had they succeeded in doing that, 9/11 would have happened 10 years earlier. One guy discovered that Shalom Ben-Dor, one of these Israeli Mossad guys, was involved in the murder of a couple Palestinians on a bus in 1984, I think it was. And based on that, they nixed the contract. Then we go further to the events of 9/11. You find that how the building was turned over. Larry Silverstein himself is a big, big Zionist in New York City, one of the former heads of the World Jewish Federation, and these huge Zionist fundraising apparatus that they have in New York City, United States. The way that Silverstein got the property through, you know, the machinations at the Port Authority under Mr. Eisenberg, who was the executive chairman of the Port Authority, the lawyers and the people working in the government of Mayor Koch at the time. Then Mayor Giuliani, all of the people who are involved in the cleanup and the destruction of the evidence in the World Trade Center are Zionists. The two junkyards where the metal was destroyed were both owned by Zionist Israeli connections. The steel was sent to China to another Zionist a steel broker over there. It was all done like that. As I said, Michael Chertoff, who ran the investigation, is himself the son of a Mossad agent who grew up in Israel. And then, you know, going on further and further, he's the one who spun the deception, who presented to the American people this list of 19 Arabs who did this, who worked on the passenger list of the airplanes, after all. So, you know, how did he come up with these names? And then furthermore, when Michael Chertoff became the Homeland Security Czar, he maintained his control over the evidence of 9/11 under a newfangled thing called the Sensitive Security Information Act, which gave him the authority to, you know, keep the 9/11 evidence hidden for another 5 years or so. And, you know, it's like that. If you read Solving 9/11, the Deception to Change the World, or if you look at my book, which contains all the articles of 12 years, you'll see that, you know, every single executive decision where the decision was made that affected the outcome of 9/11. It was either a Zionist or an Israeli making the decision. So who would they do it for? Who did the Israeli, the Zionist judge, you know, squelch or ruin the cases? 96 people, 96 families had their cases in the tort litigation court in South Manhattan under Alvin K. Hellerstein. Alvin K. Hellerstein is, his son lives on the West Bank. His son is an Orthodox Jew, lives in the West Bank, is a lawyer. And his son was actually working for the company that represented one of the key defendants in the 9/11 tort litigation. A classic case of conflict of interest when an immediate family member of the judge has a connection to one of the defendants in a case. But hey, New York media didn't see anything wrong with that. New York media, they wouldn't even tell you, they didn't even know who was destroying the evidence, for crying out loud.
And let me, go ahead. We have a caller that's been waiting on the line a couple minutes, sure. So I want to take that call and bring her on the air. Pamela, you're on the air.
Good morning, and it's good a morning. Wonderful show. I have a question, and I'll take my answer on the air. Is there any way possible that an investigation, a reinvestigation of 9/11 will ever happen? I mean, there's so much evidence that, you know, your guest is talking about and, you know, other things that I've read. But will this ever be reexamined? Or I mean, once it's done, and they've closed it and covered it up. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good question.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because it gets to the problem where we are today as a nation. That you know, I've done a lot of investigation. Architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have done a great deal of examination and investigation as well, as have many people. We presented, you know, it's clear that the government version is not correct. Now, the point is that the government never really did a criminal investigation. So we're not talking, it's like a recount of the votes. When the votes were never counted, you can't have a recount. They were never even counted. The same thing with 9/11. You're not asking for a reexamination. You're asking for an investigation to happen in the first place, a criminal investigation, because the 9/11 Commission report and these building studies that were done by the engineers, these were completely fraudulent and limited from the outset. They there's no way that they could replace the non-existing criminal investigation that should have happened. Now, how do we get there? You know, people who this is what I'm saying. People who think that Obama meant change, you know, were sadly were disappointed to see that, of course, change did not mean that there would be an investigation by the Obama administration of what happened in 9/11. And until we get an administration, until we get a revolution or whatever it takes to get an investigation of what happened on 9/11, we are not living in a normal country. Because when we are living in a country where the government is covering up what happened on 9/11 and then waging wars and defrauding the nation based on that, on those lies, well, that's simply not acceptable. That's not a normal government. So, you know, with all these things that are happening in Washington now, with the truckers that didn't the truckers and the veterans, and this is the beginning of something. You know, the American people are showing that they are absolutely outraged with the government in Washington D.C. You know, that's the problem. Until we get real political change, we're not going to have an investigation of 9/11, and that's not going to happen until we have real elections. This gets back to the fundamental problem that until we're counting our own votes in our local polling places on election night, we don't have democratic elections. And until we get real democratic elections in the United States again, we're not going to have a real republic. We're living in some sort of fantasy land where we think everything's okay for us, but really it's not.
Yeah, and of course we've been involved in this global war on terror, even though President Obama doesn't use that term. You know, he's got a different brand, but it comes out to the same thing. We're taking absolutely... it's almost insane, our foreign policy, what we're doing around the world, that we think that the military is the answer for everything. And we would never have been at this place, and not to mention or to mention the surveillance, of domestic surveillance of just about everybody in the United States and half the rest of the world. We would have never gotten here without the 9/11 event and the mythology that goes along with it.
Right.
So your point is very well taken, and maybe we have as a country, as you know, the citizenry is suffering, or at least half the citizenry apparently is suffering under the delusions that there's a whole lot of people out there that want to take away our freedom, even though there's no possible way for them to do that if they just sat and thought rationally for a couple minutes. But
right.
But they're suffering under that delusion. They believe that. So it's all right to go and bomb another country into submission, even though they've never attacked you. This is unprecedented in U.S. Well, maybe not unprecedented, but it's still a pretty radical thing. And now we're participating in assassinations weekly. Our president goes down to lists of people that we want to illegally kill. We call murder bringing somebody to justice now. We've kind of slipped a cog somewhere as Americans.
Big time, big time. You know, it's like when you talk about these things, you know, one is, of course, reminded of Vietnam. And you know, now we're looking at the 50th anniversary coming up of the murder of John F. Kennedy. And when I think about it, although I was just a first grader when Kennedy was killed, that was really the end of the Camelot. I mean, that really was. You know, we had a very idealistic president, no matter he had faults and whatnot, but he was a very idealistic president. And he was against going to wars, you know, in far off places and using terrible weapons, like Vietnam became. And you know, the same people that brought us the assassination of Kennedy, and the same people who brought us the war in Vietnam under LBJ and Nixon, are still involved in supporting Obama, for example, the Crown family of Chicago. General Dynamics, the guys who built the F-111, and who raked in millions and millions, billions of dollars off the contract for the airplanes for Vietnam, they are providing the weapons that are now being used in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, of course, they are supporting the paper called A Pathway to Persia, where they're calling for war against Iran. And this is a family that brought us, you know, from Chicago, Mr. Obama. You know, and I don't know, you're not from Chicago, but I'm from Chicago, and Mr. Obama was a complete non-entity prior to his election to the Senate, and in his election to the Senate, many people don't know this, but there was no opposition. It was a one-man race. So, you know, this whole thing, this whole charade of what we have in government today, we have a crimocracy running our country today. Let's not, you know, pretend anything else. It's a crimocracy. It's a government of criminals. The government of criminals, by criminals, and for criminals. And a government of this type is unable to bring prosperity and stability to the American people. I've seen these kinds of governments in Eastern Europe. When you have these mafia governments, they cannot deliver the goods. And that's what we see today.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a little bottom of the hour break. We're kind of past there, but I wanted to take this little break and remind listeners of some things that are going on today. And who they're listening to. So you're listening to Unspun on KKRN 88.5 FM Bella Vista. KKRN is a community radio station, is funded by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. If you wish to support our efforts, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button. A small continuing monthly donation is really appreciated because it keeps on giving to support us throughout the year. We are streaming live at KKRN, and anybody that's listening to us stream are welcome to call in too to the station at 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. There is a demonstration. Somebody called me the other night and let me know there is a demonstration. People are protesting unlabeled GMO foods and the undue influence of the Monsanto Corporation over our food supply. That demonstration starts at 11 a.m. in Reading at the Trader Joe's parking lot, and I believe I'm not sure where exactly. Maybe they're going to march down to Walmart and then back. But if you're interested in that, 11 a.m. this morning at Trader Joe's, a march against Monsanto. So that's one of the things that are going on today in Reading. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us again is Christopher Boleyn, journalist, researcher, 9/11 truth advocate. We're discussing the events of 9/11 and the implications of the evidence or the lack of evidence from that day. Call us, 337-1885. I think we do have a caller that's calling in. Maybe we'll take that right now. I think we will. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Doug. How you doing? It's Eric Manson on my latest march on against Monsanto, and we're going to Target is where we're going, to the Target.
Oh, okay.
But I guess my question for the 9/11 is how, and the whole government, everything, is how do we wake the masses of sheeple up? How do we bring it? We have the internet. We have shows like you. What else can we do to make people stop looking at which sports team is going to win, which sports team, and which, you know, fake political Republican. It's all diversionary tactics that these people just blindly follow. And
yeah,
what ways can be, like, you're doing your part, you know, the internet, which I'm definitely scared they're going to shut the internet down. They shut the internet down, they're shutting down the real lines of true communication. I'm just amazed and surprised and thankful that they haven't done that yet. I know they've had several bills to attempt that, but they've been unsuccessful. And that's, I think, one of the main things we have to make sure does not happen.
Okay, well, I'll answer part of your question, of course. And a lot of people don't know this either, but there is a separate internet for government and business. They have their own separate internet, so it's very easy for them to shut the internet down, even though it was designed to be, reproduced and find other ways automatically. If you control the physical placement of wherever the servers are or the routers, you control the internet. So you can pretty much shut it down if you want to. But they're not going to do that because so many people are busy playing, sending pictures of their puppy to Aunt Martha on Facebook and commenting about how cute that is. And so a lot of the internet is diversion and distraction too. But I want to let our guest answer your question because I think he has a much more profound answer to your question. So, Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I would say this. I grew up in without a television. My mother was against television in the house, and so I was kind of odd in my class that I didn't have TV. Everybody else was aware of Batman and Robin before. I didn't know who Batman and Robin was. And the thing is that we have to break our TV habit because TV is really the main propaganda tool that is used to placate the American people. That's very hard for people to do. But I would remind the caller that revolutions like the American Revolution do not require 99% participation. You're never going to get 99% participation. You know, it'll be a much smaller group of people, something like 20%, 10 or 20%, that are the people who bring about a revolution, bring about a change. And, clearly the United States, if you read, the basic founding documents like the Declaration of Independence, we are at a point when our government is no longer serving the people, it is no longer representing the people, and it is a source of our problems rather than a cure of our problems. And it is really time for the American people to find new, install new methods to guarantee our security and our safety. And that, I have said that since 9/11, and it's a gestation period. People are becoming more and more aware, and most people think that there has to be greater pain felt among the American people. And of course, God knows there's plenty of pain being felt in America today, and God forbid that pain increase. But what will it take before the American people are able to throw off the shackles that have bound us? We've been led down this path, and now we find that there's nothing there but debt and death and destruction, and we want out. And we've got to find a way to do that. Yeah. But it's not going to require 99% of the population.
Eric, I'm going to let you go, but I hope that answered your question. We have another caller.
Okay, thank you, Doug. You guys continue on.
Hey, well, thank you for calling in, Eric.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let me take the other caller. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Good morning. Hey, I have a question I've always been curious about 9/11. There was a PPB about planes flying into buildings and stuff. And the way I understand it, the government never issued a warning to the airlines, an alert, which would have caused people with buying one-way tickets for cash to be scrutinized and stuff. And does your guest know anything about that?
Well, let's ask him, Chris.
Well, I know that, I don't know about that per se, but I do know that there was a drill being done on the morning of 9/11 in which an airplane was to take off from Dulles Airport, which is just outside Washington. And it was going to come around and it was going to crash into the campus of the National Reconnaissance Office in Chantilly, Virginia, which is just outside the Pentagon area there. And so this plane was going to, a passenger plane was going to take off from Dulles and crash into the NRO, and they were supposed to have this drill where what would they do, where would they go, how would they handle the emergency? And when reality, NRO is very important. They work for the CIA and Department of Defense. They run the satellites. They are the eye in the sky. They run the satellites that watch the world for the United States government, for the military. And when reality intruded, we were talking about this last week too, when this drill became reality, you know what they did? They sent all of the employees home. Early in the morning on 9/11, when the first plane hit the World Trade Center, they sent all the people who manned the satellite system of the United States government, they sent them home.
Huh. Yeah, and the NSA did the same thing. The head of the NSA, Michael Hayden, did the same thing on 9/11.
So this question has never been asked of anybody.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Nobody. Your guest has done a lot of research, and a lot of other people have, but nobody has ever been held an account for not just putting in the simplest of alerts before the attack, which would have thwarted them.
Paul. But another thing is, Paul, is that there was a movie made by Mr. Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch of Fox News and News Corp. They made a movie in 2000, in Vancouver, and they filmed a movie where a plane was flown into the World Trade Center. At the very last minute, it was the pilot was able to take the plane, recover control of the plane, and avoid the hitting the tower by just inches. And this was called the Lone Gunman. The pilot was called the Lone Gunman. And it aired on TV on the Fox Channel in March of 2001. So, and millions of people watched it. So, the idea that planes could be flown into buildings like the World Trade Center, that idea was in the minds of people, millions of people, prior to 9/11. What the airlines did or didn't do, for security, that's a question that goes to the security company that was, running passenger screening for the airport. And that company was the Israeli company, ICTS, and they're the company that was in the defendant's stand in the tort litigation for 9/11, the Israeli company, because they're the ones who let the guys with box cutters supposedly get on the plane.
And another aspect of what Paul's saying, that Presidential's Daily Brief, the PDB, I think it was August 6th or August 7th, 2001, was not the only warning. There were numerous warnings. There was something called Able Danger that the military was doing. FBI agents were reporting things, and investigations were being blocked within the FBI. So there were numerous warnings. I don't know what all that noise is in the background with Paul, but we got a lot of noise going on there. But and I think to answer your question, there were purposely no alerts. I mean, it's pretty obviously there were purposely no alerts because there was never a decision to alert anybody.
Yeah, well, I find it, it's a pretty simple thing that could have been done and wasn't done. So I find it curious. So thanks for your taking my call.
Thank you for calling, Paul.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, yeah, you know, and we haven't covered that, and maybe you would like to talk to that also, Chris, the fact that there were so many FBI agents and investigations that were squelched by the Bush administration, even the terrorism czar under Bush, and Clinton was screaming. I think the description was he was acting like a man with his hair on fire in the White House, and they were all ignoring him. And so maybe you'd like to touch on prior knowledge and how can so many people actually work against alerting the American people?
Well, you know, one of the key persons was, I think, John O'Neill, who died on 9/11. He was an FBI agent who was working very much on the USS Cole attack. And the USS Cole attack is, in my mind, very similar to the USS Liberty. It was probably a missile that struck the ship, not the little blowing up of that boat. I mean, the damage doesn't look like it was caused by an inflatable raft. That looks like it was another false flag operation. The Khobar Towers looks like another false flag operation. We talked about the USS Liberty, Israeli-done terror operation. We talked about the Levon affair, perhaps, in Egypt when the Israelis attacked British and American targets in the 50s.
I don't think we actually touched on that, but we could go into that a little more detail.
Well, that was another one. That was another one where the Israelis tried to turn the United States against Egypt in 52, 53 by attacking American libraries and consulate buildings and things like that, and British buildings. And then there was the blowing up of the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1982, I think it was,
83.
Yeah. In which you know, hundreds of American Marines were killed. There again, the Israelis knew very well exactly which truck was coming that was to carry the bomb. How did they know so well which truck was going to carry the bomb? Because, you know, they are infiltrated in, and they create these little terror cells that commit these crimes. And so they knew that, too, and they only gave the Americans the skinniest of information so that the Americans were unable to defend themselves against this airport bombing. I mean, it's time and time and time again they have done this. And 9/11 is just the latest example. I mean, I forgot where this question started, but that's the point. I mean, they've been doing false flag terror attacks against the United States for decades. And 9/11 is the real wake-up call because it showed us that, well, New York City is a very, you know, Zionist-controlled city and always has been. So they did it in a place where they could control the outcome of the investigation the best. Had they done such a thing in California, it would have been harder, you know?
Yeah, I think we were talking about intelligence prior to 9/11 that was being ignored or suppressed. I know the FBI, who was it? I want to see Colleen Rowley, or maybe there was another FBI analyst that reported some of the activities of some of the hijackers, and they actually had surveillance, which was then suppressed. They were told by superiors not to go there.
Well, and that John O'Neill fellow who was running the whole Al-Qaeda investigation for the FBI was fired from the FBI, lost his job, and then was given the job as security chief at the World Trade Center. And his first day of work was on September 11th, 2001. He was killed. Some people say he was even shot. But in any case, he died at 9/11. So, you know, it's such a huge plot, very sophisticated. There's so much there are so many aspects of it that I've looked at many, many aspects in my book, Solving 9/11. And when you read my articles and when you read my thesis, you know, you come away with the inescapable conclusion that this was an Israeli Zionist plot, that they were the operators, they were the managing hands, they're the ones who did it.
Yeah, we've got about a little less than 5 minutes. I'm playing the devil's advocate again. A lot of people don't understand what a Zionist is, first of all. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the obvious question to your statement that so-and-so is a Zionist is how did you determine that these people were Zionists?
Okay, that's a good question. A Zionist is a person who is a dedicated supporter of Jewish nationalism. Now, that in and of itself is not a bad thing. But the Zionists that are concerned, that we're concerned about in 9/11, these are not just your garden variety Zionists. These are Zionists who support the party that's in power now, the Likud Party. The party that's in power now, the Likud Party, is a coalition that was created by the former terrorists of the Irgun Party and the Lehi Party, people like Yitzhak Shamir and Menachem Begin, the people who bombed hotels in Jerusalem in 1946, people who committed terrible war crimes, the people who called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. These are people who use terrorism as their method, as their tool to obtain their strategic goals, okay? Now, a Zionist is a person who is actively involved in supporting that group of people, whether it's by raising money for them or supporting them in their Israeli endeavors. And you know, this is a small group of people because it's actually a very small percentage of American Jews who identify as being Zionists. You know, most American Jews are just American Jews. But a small group of them are supporting the state of Israel, and then a small group of that are actively supporting this extremist party that's in power today.
Yeah, the people that come to mind, in my mind, there was Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz had actually worked for the Israeli government working on policy. And then they
Look at this. The guy, Larry Silverstein, the guy who owned all three towers that were demolished on 9/11, spoke with Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel today, and the head of the Likud party. Every Sunday afternoon, they spoke on the telephone for years before 9/11. Every Sunday, like, you know, I'm calling you today, but every single Sunday, Netanyahu would call Silverstein wherever they were in the world, and they would have the discussion. Now, Larry Silverstein is the guy that owned all three towers that came down on 9/11. And Netanyahu is the man who said 9/11 was very good for Israel.
Yeah,
and
I think, I think the paper, people, that's actually covered. You can go on the internet and see Netanyahu making that statement. And, of course, just to clarify that, he said it's good because the American people will now, I'm paraphrasing, will now sympathize with Israel's policies.
Yeah. He said it was very good for American-Israeli relations. But later, a couple years later, he said that it's Israel is benefiting from one thing, he said, and that is the attacks of 9/11 and the U.S. war in Iraq. Note those are two things. He said Israel is benefiting from one thing. So in his mind, in the mind of a terrorist, the terrorist act and the desired outcome are really one thing. That's how it works.
Yeah,
9/11 is what brought the war in Iraq.
Yes, and we have plenty of evidence that the Bush administration and the neoconservatives, that was their plan from the beginning, from day one in the White House. In fact, the first meeting, I think the previous head of Treasury, I want to say, what was his name? I can't remember it now. Well, you know what? That's our 1 minute music. And once again, this show has just flown by. And so I want to thank you for being with us today, Christopher Bolin, journalist, researcher, 9/11 advocate for truth. And his website is www.bolin.com, B-O-L-L-Y-N. I suggest you go there. He has two great books. I'm going to buy one. And Christopher, thanks for being on Unspun and Experiment in Truth Telling with us this morning.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, we could go on. You got two hands clapping here.
Well, I hope I'm coming to California. I'm coming to California in November.
Well, give me a call.
I'll stop by.
All right.
I'll do that.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, you've been listening to Unspun and Experiment in Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. For more, our archives are on kkrn.org. Next up, Peace Talks Radio.